Dr. John has held the Max Weber Fellowship at the European University Institute, Florence, and is a member of the board of directors of the International Research Center of the Historial de la Grande Guerre, à Péronne, en France. Her monograph, Violence Against Prisoners of War in the First World War, Britain, France and Germany, 1914-1920, that was published by Cambridge University Press in 2011, with a paperback edition published in 2013. She has co-edited two books and published over 27 scholarly articles and chapters in edited volumes on the First World War, and is currently researching the British monarchy at war of 1914-1918. So Dr. Jones' communication will address the humanitarian situation after the war, especially the relations between UK and Germany and Central Europe as well. Thank you very much.
Alors d'abord, j'aimerais remercier les organisateurs du colloque pour les journées très très intéressantes avec des communications du corps. Et merci de m'avoir invité ici. Et aussi, j'aimerais m'excuser parce que je vais poursuivre cette communication en anglais. Donc, désolé. Mais pour les questions, c'est bien sûr possible que les questions soient en français, soit en anglais. So what I want to do in this paper is to look at the issue, how the issue of humanitarian aid after the war became a way for the UK population to transition from wartime mentalities of hatred and understanding the world in a Manichaean sense of enemy and friend to peacetime mentalities of understanding the world much more in terms of markets and in terms of civilian populations. Part of this process was about a remodeling of the UK aid landscape in the immediate aftermath of the war, as national mobilisation around the wartime aid effort, which had really taken the bulk of the charitable focus for the previous war years, and that mobilisation now came to give way in the public sphere to create a shared space for new forms of international humanitarians, the kinds of neutral, impartial conceptions of aid that the ICRC had been pioneering and arguing for during the war. This discourse of a neutral, impartial humanitarianism dealt with need rather than with nationality or ethnic affiliation really starts to appear again in the public sphere in Britain in this immediate aftermath of the war. Through one key question, which is the campaign against the continuation of the Allied blockade. Now, this new humanitarianism, as I term it, is very different to the types of international humanitarian languages that had existed in the UK before the war, and which had disappeared with kinds of wartime xenophobic and antagonistic aid mobilisation around the UK's national war effort. This new humanitarianism was increasingly professional and well organised, and its key actors were ones that will be very well known to many of you. So essentially, the key question that I want to look at is transition, and these are the key actors. The Quakers, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and Save the Children, and also the Labour Movement. And these groups used the situation, the continuing Allied blockade of the former Central Powers, in particular Germany, but also Austria, as a way of mobilising a new idea of aid. That aid should be something humanitarian along the lines that the International Red Cross also defined it as, and that it shouldn't be about national and strategic interests, as it had been during the war, and that it shouldn't be about simply supporting the military or Allied war victims, as it had been during the war. And it's a very contentious issue, but the transition as it occurs from the armistice through to the end of spring 1919 is a very significant one, and it helps us to understand why, when the Treaty of Versailles occurs in May 1919 through the summer, and the Germans are protesting against it, why much of the British population actually at this point is quite receptive to some of the German arguments. The campaign against the blockade has softened British attitudes to Germany and created a sense of British guilt about this ongoing blockade after the war, and has allowed a set of new understandings of German civilians to re-emerge in the aftermath of the war. significantly was the new alignments around who merited aid. For example, did all former enemy civilians deserve aid, or just the children? Perhaps just the women and the children? Did the war disabled deserve aid? So these debates around who should get aid, which occurred through the continuation of the blockade, ultimately resulted in a kind of humanitarian discourse that actually aid should be based on need and not on past war history. And there's a very sophisticated way in which they initially used children to soften these attitudes and then spread a more international vision of what aid should be, kind of non-partisanship. Now, during the war, some of these organisations had existed and had been operating, had been talking already in the kinds of languages that the International Red Cross talked about aid, the Quakers, the labour movement, labour dissidents, and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom from 1915 had been making these arguments, but no one in majority British public opinion was interested at that point. During wartime, they are seen as dangerous, as radicals, as dissidents, affiliated with groups like conscientious objectors in the UK, who were very much despised during the war. And so they're very much marginalised, but in 1919 we see a significant change when they become major public players and really refashion the aid landscape. And the key thing here, the key backdrop to this, is that during the war you've had a shift in mentality in Britain to accepting the use of hunger as a weapon of war, a very totalising phenomenon actually, where accepting hunger as a weapon of war has become legitimate, has become unquestioned, partly these minority groups who are, as I say, largely despised, and has become something that targeting enemy civilians indiscriminately through hunger, starving them to death, has become seen as something that's very much acceptable. And this isn't just with regard to Germany. There's documentation for just after the war where the French point out to the British that they received reports from people on the ground that civilians are dying in Lebanon because of the effects of the blockade of the Mediterranean. The British say, well, that's the point in the forest. That is the point. So when we think of the wartime moment that these actors are trying to reverse after the armistice, it's a very extreme moment where radicalization has taken place and the population has accepted using hunger as a weapon of war against the enemy civilians indiscriminately. So, what is happening here? Well, humanitarian suffering, in many ways, is being used by humanitarian organisers to negate the former position of central power populations as enemies in a total war. And we see through the work of people like Mary Cox that actually, during the war, German working class children have suffered severe malnutrition. Their growth has been stunted. The German propaganda arguments around that actually are in many ways based on fact and evidence. But that after the war, the shift in British public opinion, which leads ultimately by mid-1919, it's not the spring, but by mid-1919, this change in opinion leads to feeding programs in Germany. These children actually catch up. These working class children catch up because they become the objects of this particular food aid campaign. Now, the basis for continuing the Allied maritime blockade of the Central Powers, which Germany and Austria-Hungary termed a hunger blockade, a hunger blockade from the start, hunger as weapon of war, the basis for it was Article 26 of the Armistice, which allowed Britain to continue, and the Allies, to continue to control food imports and the access of humanitarian aid organisations like the Quakers to Germany. So it's not just food imports for the German market, it's also humanitarian organisations that want to work providing aid in Germany or in Austria that are being controlled by the British government. And the Quakers are actually not let get access for quite some time, something they protest and protest and protest about. And the views on the ground are that this is initially really quite popular. This is not something the British public initially objects to. Here we see Millicent Fawcett, a very famous campaigner for women's rights and for women's suffrage, claiming in the Times, denouncing appeals that she has received from German feminists, petitions from German women sent by German feminist leaders to her, appealing to her on a kind of universal female position. Fawcett writes the Times rejecting this and saying, actually, the people of this country, meaning Britain, the UK, have a strong sense of justice and she believes the whole population, the whole country, principally supports the policy of the Allied Food Council, which is first to supply the necessities of Allied liberated peoples, then neutrals, and after that, enemy countries. So she's not particularly softening at this point, and that's quite illustrative of those first 3 months at the end of the war, going to early January. Now, what do we see? How does this campaign of kind of trying to open up the humanitarian space in Britain actually operate? Well, I'd like to make three claims here. First, humanitarianism around the campaign against the blockade in the UK becomes associated with dissent, with political dissent. And political dissent in the British sphere has a long and actually at this point quite well-regarded history. It's associated very much with British liberals, it's associated with the nonconformist churches, they're used to being in a position of being dissenters, going right back several centuries, and so associating their position of being the dissenters, the voice of kind of moral difference gives these humanitarian arguers for an international approach, opening up humanitarian aid to everyone, gives them a really strong position. This is bolstered by the fact that the British Liberal Party is very weak at this point. It is split over during the war, and so you have a sense that actually it can no longer hold the interest of those who had once been its main core vote. Instead, they mobilise through humanitarian issues. They're looking for a home to campaign around, and the humanitarian campaign against the blockade becomes one that they are attracted to. Second, the campaign reveals the extent of these changes in operation and technology around humanitarianism. So you get new use of photographs by organisations like Save the Children, you get the use of lobbying, of pamphlets, and you get a very sophisticated use of film and also a use of kind of show trial, where two key campaigners get themselves arrested and then use the trial to raise publicity about how Britain is blockading Central Europe and the effects of that. And third, the humanitarian campaigners use a very carefully constructed idea of the humanitarian as honourable witness. And this, again, goes back to the 19th century. This element is not entirely new, but they're playing on older religious languages of the witness as having religious overtones, a truthful witness, the truthful messenger who is not bearing false witness, but is bringing the truth to which audiences should respond in aiding these people. That if you know the truth, then you're kind of honour-bound to respond with aid, and if you don't, you're somehow committing an immoral act. You're neglecting or ignore the truth. Now, they face a lot of opposition, as I mentioned at the start. This is just illustrative of it. Other opposition comes from the government. The government itself is very reluctant to attenuate the blockade in any way. Germany has not yet signed a peace treaty. The armistice has to be renewed at regular intervals after the war ends. The armistice is not actually a fixed final point of total surrender. It's not similar to the end of the Second World War. The armistice is a pause. And so there is a real fear on the side of allies that Germany might take up arms again. It's a realistic fear. There is debate about that in Germany throughout the spring. And so there is this reluctance to give in to humanitarian aid aims about bringing food into Germany, and an argument that actually Germany has stockpiled food for its army in the event that the war starts up again, so it could use that food to feed its population, and these humanitarian campaigners should stop. Public opinion, however, thinks differently. And in March, the British grudgingly accept a mitigation of the blockade, allowing some foodstuff in to be sold in Germany. And again, in May 1919, they allow for further attenuation. So the government opposition is something that this campaign is able ultimately to first attenuate, and then ultimately, with the Treaty of Versailles, to really move beyond. The cartoon from the German side about what that attenuation means. You can see, even if it still comes too late, still we have paid for it. Now, that's a reference to the previous paper discussion about Hoover. They've paid, Germany's prepared to pay for some of this food aid to come in, it's asking for it, The British are saying no, trying to use that to gain leverage. The humanitarian companies are saying let the food in, and here's the food being carried into a graveyard, because by the time it's getting there, the German argument is it's simply too late, too little, too late, and it's not a full lifting, it's only a small amount being let in, and the British and French are trying very hard, you see it in their archive files, to work out how much food aid can they let in without giving Germany too much freedom to return to war. And they're trying to look at the French are surveying the population of Hamburg to find out how much food they have per week, how many calories they have, is that starvation, is that malnutrition, is that still okay? So they're really trying to watch this, and this is part of this dynamic whereby they're refusing to allow open humanitarian access to the hungry populations of Eastern and Central Europe while the blockade is continuing and the Treaty of Versailles has not been signed. Matthias Erzberger, who's the German representative to the Armistice Commission, campaigns very strongly against this. And like many German commentators, he defines this as a women and children's issue from the start. He, and I quote, says, the German people have suffered gravely through this blockade, this starvation policy of England. Now the war is to be continued during the very armistice against our women and children. The Allies will not derive any military success from that. And German campaigners link up with these humanitarian campaigners in Britain and present evidence and feed them with materials that they can use in their campaigns in Britain. So it becomes, again, quite a transnational effort to bring an idea of neutral humanitarianism into the UK public arena. And all of this ultimately feeds into this idea, as I mentioned, of dissent. Now the leaders, this is the hunger map, sorry, of the New York Times hunger map, just to illustrate the sense, this is late 1918, a sense of where the food problems and the scale of the issue, not just former defeated powers, but also broader problems more widely, collapse of Russia into revolution, civil war, etc. But to move on to the campaigners, and I mentioned that they associate themselves with this very honourable British tradition of dissent and political dissent. Key figures are people like Eglantyne Jebb. We've heard about her already in their discussions. Founder of Save the Children. Save the Children is founded out of this campaign against blockade. That is where it gets its raison d'etre. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. George Bernard Shaw, the very famous Irish writer living in the UK, he's been at the centre against the war throughout the war, but he again gets to the fore of this discussion as well. He writes in 1919, "To win this war, we starved the children of Germany and of many other lands as well. Having defeated our enemies by that means, are we going to feed the starving children, or are we out not merely for defeat, but for extermination?" And that's his words, Shaw's words, in 1919. And he argues the blockade sets a dangerous precedent, which is also interesting given the ways that hunger is then used as a weapon in later 20th century European conflicts. The main group opposing the war is the Fight the Famine Council from the armistice period. It's very left-wing and it's very radical. And it's then so radical that when Save the Children is founded, they try to distance themselves a little bit from the Fight the Famine Council because it's seen as really very socialist. Jeb is acting more out of religious motivations, and in a revealing poem talks about how, and I quote, "Now over our afternoon tea, dear friend, let's consult together why we're starving 60 million people between us, you and I. Is it to make them accept terms of peace which they otherwise wouldn't? Or is it that we may get hold of some markets we otherwise couldn't?" And she goes on to say, "The fact is I want to know the what to say when asked what my motives exactly were by God at the judgment day. For I have an increasing suspicion, though hitherto I have hid it, God will not let us off scot-free when we say that the government did it." So there's a sense, again, of non-conformism, the idea of the religious witness, and the idea that opposing the government is actually a very noble tradition and actually obligatory. Now, what we see in terms of how this campaign develops, the Manchester Guardian, a very key newspaper, is really involved in this. They have a journalist, Noel Henry Brailsford, who goes to the areas in blockaded Germany, gets himself in, and writes horrific reports about the state of the population. And then on the 6th of April 1919, there's a mass demonstration continuation of the blockade organised in London. And one of the key groups organizing it is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And they bill it as a women's demonstration. So again, that language, this is a women's mobilization issue. This is linked into the British tradition of very active suffragette movements. And it's a kind of revival, again, of pre-1914 campaigning for groups who've been doing other things during the war. They're now coming back around to this kind of mobilizing around a women's argument on this. Some of the crowd that come are actually a little bit hostile, and they managed to win them over. And at the end of the demonstration, a group march on Downing Street and knock on the door. Now, they only get to meet the Chancellor of the Exchequer, but they managed to, because the Prime Minister is apparently busy, but they managed to get an appointment with the Prime Minister a few days later as well. And the language they use to him is very revealing. They talk about how the blockade must be relaxed on three main grounds: the interests of humanity, for the sake of our national honour, and as a matter of expediency. And the head of the delegation, Mrs. McKenna, says, "It was inconsistent to leave the workers of the nation to starve, and at the same time to endeavour to extract from that nation an indemnity to repair the damages of war. Every day that the blockade continued, the constitution of the nation became more deeply undermined and its productive power correspondingly diminished." And McKenna's quite close to eugenic arguments there, which turn up in some of this material as well, about the stunting of the German nation and how this is not going to be good for Europe's future. Again, linking back to the Hoover paper about the stunting of the future generations of Europe. There's a mass letter-writing campaign by these groups to the government. Mr. G. Roberts, who was the food controller and an MP, said, "I get a considerable number of resolutions day by day passed by various bodies protesting against the continuance of the blockade, as though the blockade were now the sole cause of the distress prevalent over large tracts of Europe." Now, the mayor of Manchester is a little more problematic as well. He rejects some of these humanitarian arguments. The Women's International League asked him to help them establish a fund to aid starving children in Europe. And he says he'll only do that if they can assure him the food will go to children of the Allied nations. Allied nations only. And the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom refuse. Now, to go back to that April the 6th demonstration, one of the key moments of that demonstration is when Eglantine Jebb, here behind me, and Barbara Ayrton Gould from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom get themselves arrested by handing out provocative leaflets at the demo. This is the leaflet that they get arrested for. Now, why does this leaflet cause such public offence that these two middle-class, very worthy in the British class system, bourgeois women who normally would not be targets for arrest, why does it get them arrested? Well, I'd argue it's because it's the exact antithesis of the reasons why Britain went to war. All the propaganda in 1914 in Britain, which, remember, is brought in around the Liberal Party's argument of saving the children of Belgium who are having their hands cut off by the nasty, evil German army, is reversed by this image of Britain starving European children. It completely turns on its head the whole raison d'etre for why Britain fought the war in the first place. And that's incredibly difficult for a British public to accept. And the trial of Ayrton Gould and of Jebb becomes a cause célèbre. The judge at the trial ultimately actually donates to their fund, and they're let go free. The National Labour Press was also involved in printing these pamphlets, and William Francis Moss from the National Labour Press is also summoned as part of this. And the language here, "our blockade has caused this," is the key thing. And very, very powerful. And here again, another image where you can see the kinds of material that they're showing. Again, I said they use photography incredibly effectively. This goes back a little bit to David's paper earlier. They use it as a way of mobilising and of almost dramatising the urgency of what's going on. And again, really hammering the older 1914 argument as to why Britain had entered the war. It becomes very clear. The previous pamphlets said, "We are responsible, how can we stop it?" So it's again that idea of moral witness, of truthful witness, evidence-based. You've got the weight of the child listed, and this sense that actually the public should act to stop this. On the 19th of May, there is then a major meeting at the Albert Hall to kind of move on from the publicity generated by the trial, at which the Manchester Guardian journalist I mentioned, Henry Noel Brailsford, speaks. And again, this meeting emphasises innocent children's suffering and the special duty of women humanitarian activists, and the fact that, they have a particular position of moral and integrity in the situation. One woman speaker on stage, again, this illustration of the dramatic, waves a tin of condensed milk and says, there is more practical morality in this tin than in all the creeds. So again, a dramatisation of some of the neutral rhetoric around humanitarianism that we saw at the International Red Cross, but being put in a very spectacular way. Now, one of the reasons for that, this audience queuing up to get in, is not all supportive of humanitarian aid. Some people have come along to throw things at the speakers. But again, they are won over by the arguments and by the images, and by the way that some of the speakers, such as Robert Smiley, describe the blockade as the disgrace of the people of this country. And say if the children alone, remember I mentioned multiple actors, but say if the children alone raises almost £400,000 in the first year of campaigning. And that's a huge amount of money, and that money is raised specifically for those who are victims of the blockade. So that's money for the former enemy. So you can see here how this movement, how this language of radical dissent, of reviving old liberalism but in new channels towards the international humanitarianism, is actually changing attitudes in Britain before we get to Versailles, before we get to the question of the kind of Carthaginian peace, which the British public becomes very uncomfortable about. So to move to the conclusions, ultimately public opinion does shift, and the shift happens earlier than the Treaty of Versailles. A lot of the political arguments are that public opinion changes in response to the harsh Treaty of Versailles in the UK. No, it doesn't. It changes earlier. It changes, it really March and April is a significant point where these campaigners start having a big impact. And secondly, the moral arguments of these groups, which have been so marginal during the war, now become much more significant in the public sphere. And we can see this. And this, in turn, changes the British understanding of what humanitarian aid is about, and internationalises it, and really worries the government, which wants to use all these issues of aid in terms of national strategic foreign policy leverage in Europe. And then we see this this way in which they're actually interpolating older British cultures here. This is not, on the one hand, you have the movement of languages from, say, Geneva to London, but on the other hand, you also have this this building on older languages as well as a way of making those points and a way of developing and re-establishing peacetime moral norms whereby children or women, certain groups, should be protected by virtue of need, which is very, very significant. And so what I ultimately want to suggest is that the campaign against the blockade again shows the fluid nature of First World War radicalisation. You can radicalise a population quite quickly in the First World War. The fact that England goes for this very extreme and total form of blockade, the fact that it has such huge consequences in the Ottoman Empire and Eastern and Central Europe, and that they're prepared to go that far, is very extreme, but you can de-radicalise just as quickly. And so there's some very interesting cycles of violence being reversed during this phase between the armistice and the Treaty of Versailles in the British case. The problem, and I'll leave you with the problem, is that that's not happening in Germany. For the Germans, while it's all very nice that there is this shift in Britain and that there are these humanitarian efforts being made, see this very much as a moment where they tried to raise awareness that continuing blockade after the war was immoral and cruel, and some Germans argue it's illegal. It is actually technically legal, I would like, but they may argue it's illegal. But it is in Germany taken as a sign that actually in the future we must stand on our own, we cannot rely on international humanitarianism, it doesn't get us anywhere, it's too slow, and those right-wing narratives in Germany are very significant going forward into planning for what becomes the next war, the Second World War, and kind of a retreat from the idea of the international as humanitarian organisations in where you can appeal through them to the enemy. The fact that this appeal, even after the war, as they see it, has ended, doesn't really change much very quickly. For Germany, it's very much seen as a negative.